Hello, I'm Butch Ball with the Virginia Voice. Welcome to today's music news. The article today, the first one anyway, is in the New Yorker magazine. Came out today, April 15th, 2024, written by Alex Ross, entitled Annals of Sound, What is Noise? Sometimes we embrace it, sometimes we hate it, and everything in between depends on who's making it. Noise is a fuzzy word, a noisy one. In the statistical sense, its meanings run the gamut from the negative to the positive, from the overpowering to the mysterious, from anarchy to sublimity. The negative seems to lie in the root. Etymologists trace the word to nuisance, a nausea. Noise is what drives us mad. It sends the grink over the edge at Christmas time. Oh, the noise, the noise, the noise. Noise is the sound of madness itself, the din within our minds, the demented narrative of Poe's The Tell-All Tale. The tell-tale heart jabbers about noise while he hallucinates his victim's heartbeat. Quote, I found the noise was not within my ears. The noise steadily increased. The noise steadily increased. Yet noise can be righteous and majestic. The Psalms are full of joyful noise, noise unto the Lord. In the book of Ezekiel, the voice of God is said to be like the noise of many waters. In Paradise Lost, heaven makes infernal noise as it beats back the armies of hell. Public enemies bring the noise, marshals forces for a different kind of battle. At the same time, the word can summon all manner of gentler murmurs. The aisle is full of noises, sounds and sweet airs. Tennyson speaks of a noise of hymns, Coleridge of a noise like of a hidden brook. In Elizabethan England, a noise could be a musical ensemble, such as the one that supplied a heavenly melody for Queen Elizabeth's first coronation pageant. Any hope of limiting the scope of the term evaporates when the information theorists detach it from acoustics altogether and apply it to any ambient activity that hinders the signal. Noise has become to mean an engulfing barrage of data, less an event than a condition. Other languages handle noise a bit less vaguely. In French, the most common term is bruit, which comes from the Latin for roar. That's a straightforward description of what a noise sounds like, as opposed to a subjective assessment of how it might upset us. In German, Lärm tends to indicate louder noises, Geräusch, softer, more natural ones. Russians have a range of words, including Schlumm, which, according to Vladimir Nobility, suggests more of a swoosh than a racket. When Osip Mandelsam wrote of Schon Vermina, meaning the noise of time, he captured an essential texture of modern life. Noise is capricious enough to have inspired a small, ever-growing library, alongside various cultural histories. Bart Kosko's Noise, David Henley's Noise, Mike Goldsmith's Discord, The Story of Noise, Hillard Swartz's 900-page Making Noise. You can read the accounts of a noise music scene, Japanese, New York Noise, Noise-based Literary Criticism, Shakespeare's Noise, Kafkrafta and Noise, The Philosophies of Noise, an External Example of Noise. Noise, Noise Matters, Toward an Oncology of Noise, not to mention practical-minded guides to reduce noise from your HVAC unit, or reducing the noise in your head. How noise relates to music is a much brooded topic in itself. Samuel Johnson's offers an elegant resolution. Quote, of all noises, I think music is the least disagreeable. End quote. Music is our name for the noise that we like. With universal definition hovering out of reach, the discourse concerning noise often starts with the personal. My history with the thing is fraught. I hate it and I love it. As a child, I was extraordinarily sensitive to loud sounds. Family expeditions to the 4th of July fireworks displays or steam railroad museums routinely ending with me running in tears to the safety of the car. When, in early childhood, I moved into the noise cauldron of New York City, I was tormented by my neighbor's stereos and by the rumble of the street. I stuffed windows with pillows and insulation. I invested in adult strength earplugs. I positioned an oversized window fan next to my bed. The neurosis had subsided, but I remained that maddening hotel guest who switches rooms until he finds one that overlooks an air shaft or an empty lot. For a while, I was drawn to music, and all music that others would pay money to avoid. Having grown up with classical music, I found my way to the refined bedlam of the 20th century avant-garde Edgar Varèse, John Cage, Karlheinz Stockhausen, Georg Lichtig. In college, I hosted a widely unheard radio show in which I broadcast things like Ligeti's Pomen Symphonique, a piece for 100 metronomes. When someone called in to report that the station's signal had gone down, I protested that we were in fact listening to music. Similarly, misunderstandings arose when I aired John Cage's Imaginary Landscape No. 4 for 12 radios. When I moved on to so-called popular music, I had ears only for the churning dissonance of Cecil Taylor, AMM, and Sonic Youth. I became the keyboardist for a noise band, which made one proudly chaotic public appearance in 1991. At one point, my bandmates and I improvised over a tape loop of the minatory opening chords of Richard Strauss's Die Frau ohne Strafen. Obviously, my issues with noise pivot on the question of control. When the noise occurs on my terms, I enjoy it. When it's imposed upon me, I recoil. The bifurcation is typical, even if I represent an extreme case. Garrett Keyser, in his incisive 2010 book, The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise, observes that the noise-slash-music distinction is ultimately an ethical one. If you elect to hear something, it's not noise, even if most people might deem it unspeakably horrible. If you're forced to hear something, it is noise, even if most people might deem it incredibly gorgeous. Pardon me. I apologize, dear listener. The spring pollen is in my head. Going forward. Thus, Keyser writes, Lou Reed's metal machine music performed at the Gramercy is not noise. Gregorian chant piercing my bathroom wall is. Unwanted sound is the basic definition. An act of aggression is implied. Someone is exercising power by projecting sound into your space. Sometimes the act is unconscious. People don't realize how loud the speakers are, or they assume that everyone loves the music just as much as they do. Sometimes, though, it's a gesture of undisguised brutality. Late one night in 2002, I asked some frat boyish neighbors to turn down that thumping techno. They responded by turning it up. When I complained again, one of them began shouting, "Faggot!" and hurling his body against my door. I lacked the presence of mind to remark upon the irony of homophobes blasting techno in Chelsea, of all places. We seldom reject the sounds of people like us. Disputes are over about noise-exposed social fissures. The classic cinema study of music, noise, and violence is Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, in which Radio Raheem brings his boombox inside Sal's pizzeria, blaring Public Enemy's Fight the Power. Sal says, "What did I tell you about that noise?" Radio Raheem protests, "This is music, my music." Minutes later, he's dead, the victim of a police killing. The perception of hip-hop as black noise, the title of a 1994 book by the pop culture scholar Tricia Ross, is part of a long history of sonic dehumanization directed at minority groups. The word barbarian originates from a disparaging Greek term, barbarios, which appears to invoke the alleged gibberish of foreign people. Bar, bar, bar. The musicologist Ruth McCohen has tracked long-standing European perceptions of Jews as particularly noisy people. Lachrymwit in den Judenstein, or noise as in a synagogue, it remained a popular German expression into the Nazi period. Mandelstam inverts these perceptions in The Noise of Time, relishing the intricacies of Jewish chaos. Colonizers who disdained the weird sounds of native peoples overlooked the fact that they themselves were causing unprecedented levels of commotion. Bells and trumpets and guns and cannons and machines, noise enables power. As Kaiser writes, it's a way of saying, the world is mine. Amid the hubbub of urban life, silence in a luxury of the rich. They can afford the full floor penthouse apartment, the house that sits on a quiet acre. They can install triple pane windows and pump insulation into the walls. They can, if they choose, become Proust in his cork-lined room. For the rest of the society, noise is an index of struggle. Hindley's Noise, which is based on a 2013 BBC radio series, documents the ruckus of tenement living in the 18th century, Edinburgh, and the altogether hellish clamor inflicted on ironworkers in 19th century Glasgow. A doctor wrote of a group of Glasgow boilermakers, "The iron on which they stand is vibrating intensely under the blows of perhaps 20 hammers wielded by 20 powerful men, confined by the walls of the boiler. The waves of sound are vastly intensified and strike the trumpet with appalling force." The colossal calamity of the Industrial Revolution prompted some of the first serious efforts at noise control. Often these amounted to crabby elitisms. Charles Babbage lamented the organ grinders and other similar nuisances that were degrading the productivity of intellectual workers. Charles Dickens signed a letter claiming that writers and artists had become special objects of persecution by brazen performers on brazen instruments. But in New York City, anti-noise activist Julia Barnett Rice, who founded the Society for the Suppression of Unnecessary Noise in 1906, transcended upper-crust narcissism by arguing that people of all backgrounds were suffering from excessive noise in school and hospitals. She intuited that scientific studies later confirmed that noise can inhibit learning and complicate health. It can also, of course, cause auditory damage in the form of tinnitus and hearing loss. Attempts to mitigate and legislate noise levels run up against the challenge of adjudicating the sounds that are excessive and unpleasant. Measuring loudness in itself is a tricky business. The decibel scale, like the Riker scale, is logarithmic, and it amounts to a quickly neutral response to a changing stimuli. A 20-decibel sound is generally perceived as being twice as loud as a 10-decibel sound, yet the actual intensity is 10 times greater. Furthermore, the decibel scale is customarily weighed to factor in the additional peculiarities. We are more sensitive to upper frequencies. A soprano is more conspicuous than a bass. To indoor sounds, to nighttime sounds. With all these complexities, noise codes, where they exist, are difficult to enforce. In 2022, New York City's Department of Environmental Protection received nearly 50,000 complaints but imposed monetary penalties in only 123 instances. Emergency warnings, foghorns, locomotive whistles, ambulance and fire truck sirens, air raid sirens, all fall into a special category of necessary life-saving noise. Car horns are a borderline case. Sometimes they stave off disaster, but more often they foster road rage. Matthew F. Jordan's Danger Knows Claxton, The Horn That Changed History, studies one of the most perversely obnoxious noises of modern times, the auga, that honk that became ubiquitous on American roads in the early 20th century. It's a free-for-all traffic environment. Drivers alerted to pedestrians and other vehicles by using the horn incessantly. Ads for the klaxon, invented by the electric engineer Miller Reese Hutchinson and introduced in 1907, boasted of its ability to cut through and kill musical sounds. Raw panic was the aim. During the First World War, the klaxon was used to warn of gas attacks, but then it declined in popularity because it traumatized veterans, and they reacted poorly to its squawk. We humans have a high tolerance for noise despite our ambivalence. In some way, we seem to require it. Other species feel differently about the never-ending sonic havoc of the Caesar Anthropocene. Caesar, say Barr, Henderson, in a book of noises, notes that when our species stays mostly indoors during the summer or the early months of the COVID pandemic, the animal world reacted with apparent relief. Bird songs regained qualities that had been recorded decades earlier, when cities were quieter. The white-crowed sparrows, for instance, extended their sound back down into a lower frequency, and their songs became richer, fuller, and more complex. Birds also sang more softly, as they had been shouting before, just as people raise their voices on a construction site or at a noisy party or even a noisy restaurant. Their stress levels likely increase and go down. Noise is another dimension of humanity's ruination of the natural world. The advance of technological music, noise, in the 20th century, such as cars, airplanes, helicopters, pile drivers, lawnmowers, leaf blowers, home stereos, stadium sound systems, left the impression that the world was getting louder year by year. This may have been so, but in recent decades, there has been actually a leveling off or even a decline in a certain type of noise. Jet engines are less thunderous than they were in the 70s. The increasing popularity of electric vehicles has brought about a situation in which cars can be dangerously inaudible to pedestrians. Artificial engine noise has become a feature of electric models. People now routinely listen to music on laptops and headphones, reducing the incursions of bass. These modest gains are offset by the rise of informational noise, which further blurs the meaning of the already confused parent word. Chin Pang Yang's Transforming Noise, A History of Its Science and Technology from Disturbing Sounds to Informational Eras, 1900 to 1955, is thick with mathematical equations, yet it still tells an interesting story even for those of us who will skip to the more technical stuff. Beneath the vehicular roar in the years around 1900 was a simmering new electronic sound native to the telephone, the phonograph, the radio, and other forms of transmission and reproduction. Yang describes its noise as disturbances and fluctuations of electrical current due to the movements of microscopic charge carriers in electronic tubes and other circuit components. Such sounds weren't aggressively unpleasant, yet they hampered the communication of messages, verbal or musical. Scientists and engineers set about studying this electronic sizzle and figuring out how to reduce it. The investigation soon intersected with the ongoing inquiries into the movement of gas and liquid particles. Einstein's papers on Bravonian motion between 1905 and 1908 not only established the existence of atoms but also helped systemize the discipline of statistical mechanics, which describes patterns of random fluctuations over time. Also known as the scholastic process. Defense work during the Second World War adapted those insights to military ends, devising uncrackable cryptography, resisting signal jamming, reducing interference in anti-aircraft radar systems. Claude Shannon, the founder of information theory, took an even more significant step by demonstrating how a signal can cope with a noisy channel, literally or figuratively, if it behaves in a noisy, stochastic way. By spreading itself across a broad spectrum, it transmits more effectively. The insight underpins modern cellular and wireless communications. It was a curious extension of the logic of the klaxon. In a world full of noise, you can punch through by making noise at a superior level. Soon enough, the concept of stochastic noise, often simplified to the point of vanishing, achieved currency in a dazzling array of fields. Noise studies of recent decades examine preparations in the stock market. The economist Fisher Black's paper, Noise, Unreliably Patterns in Decision-Making, Daniel Kahneman, Olivia Simoni, and Cass Sunstein's Noise, A Flaw in Human Judgment, and Irregularities in Political Polling, Nate Silver's The Signal and the Noise, the proposed corrective for such errancy is often the dreaded algorithm. Kahneman and company argued that algorithms, being noise-free, can outperform human judgment. Machine learning protocols in artificial intelligence, meanwhile, rely heavily on stochastic process, and the ultimate import of much of this work is that the humans are themselves randomly fluctuating particles in which behavior in aggregate can be forecast by probabilistic methods. Ying helps out the mathematical illiterate by offering a literate frame for noise semantic shift. In his introduction, he juxtaposes a 9th-century account of invasive sound, Nathaniel Hawthorne's dismayed reaction to a train whistle, with the Reagan-era datascape in Don Lillo's White Noise, with its swarm of words and pictures and numbers and facts, graphics, statistics, specs, waves, particles, and motes. White noise is the sound field in which all frequencies are equally intense. When the married couple at the novel center, Babette and Jack, have a conversation about death, the crack of doom becomes a wash of static. What if death is nothing but sound? Electrical sound? Electrical noise? You hear it forever, sound all around. How awful. Uniform. White noise. White noise is the master noise in which all of the noises are drowned out. The perpetual swirl of cultural particles mutes the reticence of the individual voice. The irony is that the atomized buzz common in so many late-century technologies like fax machines, dial-up modems, the hiss between stations on a radio dial, the poltergeist snow of a TV left on overnight has largely faded. Such noise now resides in our minds as we fend off notification updates, just-for-you suggestions, consumer feedback requests, obscene spam, clickbait, headlines, AL-generated news stories, AL-generated news stories about AL, and the whole silently screaming at the rest of us. From time to time, nature unleashes a noise so immense that it restores the biblical grandeur of the word. Many books on noise mention the Indonesian volcano Krakatoa, which in August of 1883 disgorged what's commonly called the loudest sound in modern history. The eruption was audible from as far away as 3,000 miles. The captain of a British ship that was 40 miles distant wrote, "So violent are the explosions that the eardrums of over half my crew have been shattered. My last thoughts are for my dear wife. I'm convinced that the day of judgment has come." Supreme among noisemakers is Yoko Ono, who first made her name as a principal provocateur in the downtown New York scene. Next to her is John Cage. He looked timid and then shot to global fame, though her relationship with John Lennon. Her furiously nuanced screaming of the word why at the beginning of Yoko Ono's Plastic Ono Band from 1970 was a masterly act of one-upmanship in the space of the masculine assault of mainstream rock and roll. Beatles fans, confronted with the noise of a higher order, were as aghast as the socialite aristocrats who booed the Rites of Spring. Noise is only one part of Ono's practice. She is equally drawn to meditative gentleness, but she deserves a central place in history for the genre. For the most part, she has been left out of it. Implicit in the art of noise is the promise of resistance. For millennia, music has been a medium of control. Noise, it follows, is a liberation. Schoenberg went so far as to speak of the emancipation of the dissident, making his harmonic innovation sound like a civil rights matter. The social theorist Jacques Attali, in his 1977 book Noise, The Political Economy of Music, put a sophisticated spin on the argument. The brute novae that Attali hears and meets and emerges from free jazz and the European avant-garde has a revolutionary import. It denies the marketplace. It refutes popular taste. It involves inventing new codes and playing for one's own pleasure. Subsequent treatises, such as Paul Herregaut's Noise/Music, have maintained the Himmelblatt's duality while reversing its biases so that noise, heroically, destroys music-stifling banalities. Stephen Graham, who teaches courses on underground music at Goldsmiths in London, takes a different tack in Becoming Noise Music, a survey in the field that once was in the 70s. Aware of the murkiness surrounding the notion of resistance, Graham focuses instead on the genre's aesthetics. Furthermore, the opposition of noise and music dissatisfies him. The appeal is the grittiest of all genres lies precisely in the erasure of the boundary between the two. There's no way of talking about noise without taking pleasure into account. The pleasure may be confined to a niche audience, but perhaps a somewhat masculinity one, but it exists all the same. No one chooses to listen to a sound because of what it's not. Stephen Graham once wrote, "I flow into the hearing world, staying there as the music keeps changing and changing. It's possible to transcend, trance, in this way, with more conventional music, but the low rate of repetition and the high rate of density and strainness to noise means that such trancing can have a particular rich tensile quality when it's achieved. The music takes me out of myself and makes me cosmic." Such effusions are a bit embarrassing to read, but any critic who wishes to capture pleasure must embarrass the reader sooner or later. I experience feelings similar to Graham's when I lose myself in the spells of musical noise, you know, in some way opera or in some ways even Asian. But what I love about noise is its insistence on otherness, on difference. If music were ever to become a universal language, it would always end up dead. And that article was in the New Yorker magazine entitled, "What is Noise?" Written by Alex Ross, published on April 15th, 2024. That's all the time we have for Music News Today. I'm Butch Ball with the Virginia Voice. Thanks for listening.